Good afternoon and welcome to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy, joined today by my co-host, Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. Our topic today is victims' rights within the court system. Alaska has two entities that work to support victims' rights, the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights and the nonprofit Victims for Justice. Today, we'll speak with representatives from both agencies on the scope of their work, as well as how they collaborate and how they differ in their roles. This topic comes at a time of great public interest in the victims' rights movement. Our conversation today has the backdrop of the Me Too movement, a grassroots response to sexual harassment and sexual assault in the workplace, the university, and athletics. Some advocates say this movement has made more progress than any sexual harassment laws on the books in bringing the issue to the foreground and in putting women's legal rights front and center, essentially giving women due process. Others see gradations of guilt for the accused and the danger of a one-size-fits-all view of interactions between men and women, and even a lack of due process for the accused. Here in Alaska, we have our own local history related to victims' rights. In addition to the crime that gave rise to Victims for Justice, we are also in the middle of a state budget crisis, criminal justice reform, an opioid crisis, and the rash of urban thievery, and accusations that public safety in rural Alaska, supplied by paraprofessionals and an understaffed state trooper agency, is inadequate. How are victims' rights served or colored by these events? We've got links to these agencies' websites and also links to interesting articles about the victims' rights issue on our website. So if you could only have to remember one website, it's alaskapublic.org. Go to Hometown, scroll down, and you'll see links to lots of useful information, including a judicial counsel handbook for victims' rights that I found on the internet and put the link on. I also would like to invite listeners to be a part of the conversation. Perhaps you've been on a jury, or perhaps you were the victim of a crime, or you just have questions about the movement. So we welcome your questions, and you can give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage, and statewide that number is 1-888-353-5752. And we also welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So now I'd like to just throw the ball over to my co-host, Elaine Andrews, to introduce our guest.
Thank you, Kathleen. Well, we have really an interesting topic for this event, and it's we're not going to have enough time to cover everything that we want to cover, but we are going to get started with our two guests here. Taylor Winston is the Executive Director of the Office of Victims' Rights. Taylor grew up in Texas and graduated from the Georgetown Law School in 1997. She moved to Alaska, clerked for a trial judge in Anchorage, became a prosecutor. She was a prosecutor for 13 years. She prosecuted domestic violence and sexual assault cases, as well as homicide cases. She did that both in Anchorage and in the Bethel area. And she became director of the Office of Victims' Rights in 2012. We also have with us Michelle Evans. She is a victim advocate for the Victims for Justice, a nonprofit agency. She has been a victims advocate for 3 years. She has a background in criminal justice. She has previously been an advocate for abused and neglected children, and she has been a bereavement counselor for the hospice organization, so well-steeped in issues of loss and victimhood. So two dynamic guests, and let's get the ball rolling here. And maybe I'll start by asking Taylor a little bit about what drives her passion in this and what her agency does. And you are the director of a state agency. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. The Office of Victims' Rights is centered here in Anchorage. This is where our office is. But we serve crime victims throughout the entire state of Alaska who have suffered a crime. So if a person has been victimized here in Alaska, but maybe they're from Minnesota, we can still help them. We help victims of any type of felony crime. So whether it's a burglary, theft, arson, robbery, you know, an assault with a vehicle, anything like that. Of course, rapes and assaults. And then any victim of a misdemeanor crime at the A level, which is the higher misdemeanor level, when it's a people crime or domestic violence crime. We're a free service, and we provide legal representation to the crime victim in the criminal case. So we deal with municipal cases here in Anchorage and state cases, but we don't do federal or military cases. That's outside of our jurisdiction. And we have four attorneys who have all been prosecutors before and all done work in the bush before. We have an investigator who doesn't do independent investigations but is a law enforcement liaison, and then a couple of support staff here. And, you know, one thing I want people to know about our office is that we will try to help in any way we can for a crime victim at any point after the case has been reported to police. So it could be the day of, but if it's reported to police, up until the time the case is closed within the system, meaning the person is no longer on parole or probation, if the case has been charged but dismissed with prejudice, meaning that it can't be renewed, that would also be like an endpoint. But anything else we can help with. So we can help with parole hearings. We can help with trying to figure out if a decline was reasonable by the prosecution, or even looking at why an investigation might be taking potentially too long with police and kind of stagnant.
So if a person is a victim and the case was reported to the police and went to the prosecutor and the prosecutor declined to prosecute, you still will work with that victim even though it's declined?
Yes.
Okay.
We will review the case and determine whether, you know, there was due diligence on the part of the prosecutor. Was there a good reason for the decline? If we find that there wasn't due diligence or not a good reason for the decline, then we will address those concerns with the prosecution and see if maybe there'll be a change in that circumstance. And sometimes, unfortunately for a victim's ears, we will review it and find that it was a reasonable decision by the prosecution, or the police and the prosecution did everything they could do, and it's just the end of the road for the case.
Okay. And Michelle, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your agency, and then we can dig down as to both of you on specific questions.
Sure. So Victims for Justice was started back in 1985, and it was a result of the two sisters, Sharon Nahorny and
I addressed this when we promoted
Janice Lienhart.
Janice
Lienhart and Sharon Nahorny. They were the daughters of the Faccios who were killed. And then as they started, you know, moving through that criminal justice process, it became very clear to them how little rights they had to have a voice in that process. And it became very clear to them when the one defendant was a juvenile and they were not allowed any information regarding that process. And so that was kind of impetus for them to develop the organization and, move towards changing the legislation to look towards victims' rights. And then once they got through that and, were able to get victims' rights established, the beginnings of those established in the state of Alaska, they moved on to several different entities of kind of just looking into what they could provide maybe policy-wise or ended up doing a lot. I've heard stories where, if there was a homicide in Anchorage, they would just show up at those people's doors because they knew what it was like, and they knew that they were going to need somebody to walk with them through that journey, somebody that was a layperson, somebody that could just be a navigator and help them find the resources that might be helpful.
Well, and, personal disclosure here. I mean, interestingly enough, these two women didn't just work in the victims' rights arena, because I served with Sharon Nahorny on the Judicial Conduct Commission for a number of years. So she was active in all justice issues over a period of time, and certainly met her sister, Janice, over the years as well. So it is interesting to me in a place like Alaska where the state is so small, sort of citizen involvement can really make a difference. I think of these two women and Victims for Justice and Mothers Against Drunk Drivers was started by a local woman down in Girdwood who lost her grandchildren, and other people who've advocated for change, and they set themselves on a mission and you know, they get it done. It's made a difference. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting.
Absolutely. It is. It's powerful. It's very powerful. So I wondered whether we should, I know you kind of touched on it, but what are victims' rights? I know there's a constitutional part, Article 1, Section 24. Mm-hmm. I don't want to really read it because it's kind of constitutional language, but a big one is that they have the right to be reasonably protected from the accused through the imposition of bail, things like that, the right to confer with the prosecution, the right to be treated with dignity, respect, and fairness during all phases of the criminal and juvenile justice process, the right to timely disposition of the case following the arrest of the accused, the right to obtain information about and be allowed to be present at all criminal, or that's a big one, being present at hearings, because that was what was triggered by the two sisters. Let's see. And at any proceeding where the accused's release from custody is considered, the right to restitution from the accused, and the right to be informed upon request of the accused escape or release from custody before or after conviction or juvenile adjudication. So my question is, this was in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. How did it affect this, the Linehart's and Horney's? And were these just not being followed? Or is this an amendment to the Constitution? Or what?
It was an amendment to the Constitution. Okay. So it came about later than our initial Constitution for the state. So, yeah. And that was part of this movement.
1994.
So after that.
Yes.
So it almost parallels the history of the movement, even in the United States, because it really wasn't as active as it has become recently.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so just to kind of break that down for the rights that come up most often and seem to be most important for victims, although there are quite a few rights also statutorily, but the main ones do fall within the Constitution. For us, what we see is the biggest issue for victims is that timely disposition of the case. This is the thing that most of our victims complain either in part or full about, is how long it's taking the case to get to some conclusion. Sometimes it's 5, 6, 7 years that they're waiting for justice, so to speak.
Well, one question I have is, are budget cuts and loss of prosecutors and things like that, are those arguments that have any sway, or we're just in a budget crunch and there's just nothing we can do?
I mean, this has been a problem that's been going on
before budget cuts.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And I think that what we see, because we serve the entire state, we see some court systems, such as Fairbanks and Palmer, they tend to move cases much faster than Anchorage does. So some of our cases that have the longest teeth for being old fall within the Anchorage court system. And part of that is just the way business is done. I mean, I have a 5-year-old embezzlement case that has had no motions filed in 5 years and is still going on. There's no reason for it to still be going on, except for the judges have just agreed to every continuance requested. Mm.
Let me just throw out our phone numbers. And if you've just tuned in, we're talking about victims' rights today on Justice Alaska, on Hometown Alaska. We have Taylor Winston, director of the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights. You just heard her speaking. And Michelle Evans, the lead victim advocate for Victims for Justice. And I'm, of course, co-hosting with Senior Judge Elaine Andrews. I had a question right on the tip of my tongue, but I wanted to give out the numbers. 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or also we welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. We've got experts in the studio. If you have a question, all questions are welcome, because this is a chance to learn about victims' rights in Alaska. So I'm trying to remember what my other question was. Do you have one, Elaine?
I'm going to put my oar in the water a little bit on these long continuances, because that's a three-legged stool. Someone is asking for a continuance. It could be the prosecution, it could be the defense. Each side has the right to oppose it. The judge can grant it or deny it. So, I mean, I think I'm just going to have to, on behalf of the judiciary, say, you know, judges cannot keep things under advisement for more than 6 months or they lose their paycheck. So this is not a situation in which something has been pending before a judge who's failed to decide.
It's fallen off the table.
This is, oftentimes, especially, I would guess, in an embezzlement case, you've got perhaps, I don't know anything about any particular case, but they tend to be paper intensive. And so if there's a lot of discovery, in other words, there's lots of file rooms worth of paper, as there are in a lot of complex cases, whether they're embezzlement or homicide, you got to give each side a fair shot to get prepared. Otherwise, if you force people to trial too soon, then they have a good appeal point that the court did not give them an adequate time to prepare. So, you know, it's a delicate balance you walk to move the things along and not create reversible error.
But just to be a devil's advocate, why would you see a different pace in, say, Palmer? Is it the number of cases, or what would they come back to that?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I know there's been an enormous retirement and replacement of judges in the last 4 to 5 years. We've had probably a 60% or 70% turnover, just as a matter of judges aging out of the system and retiring. And every time the judge retires, someone takes over their caseload, and if it's a very complicated case, it has to come up to speed again. But that could, other than that, actually, I do think that there is something called a legal culture, and I think that people have to take, as a presiding judge, I knew about that. You had to take control and move it. Otherwise, it's easier for everyone to say, let's take care of that next week instead of this week.
It can get sluggish.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is, I have to join
Michelle,
in with Taylor and saying, you know, from the time I get someone in my office, especially if it's a homicide case, I start prepping them every time I talk with them about the fact that this is a marathon, that if it's a homicide case specifically, it's going to be about 2.5 years before we can even look at going to trial. Taylor and I have sat down with families together, just trying to reinforce that, because the timely disposition is something that they're looking for. They're looking for some closure. They are hoping that once they hit that step, that's when things are going to feel better, when they're going to breathe better. Oftentimes, that's not necessarily the truth, and I start addressing that as well. You know, that they have to start looking at a new normal, and even before, you know, you get to trial, you kind of have to start making life in a different way, because this has happened to you. It is now a part of you. How are you going to be able to move forward with that? And trying not to make a trial a focal point. It's very difficult, but, you know, continuously talking with people about that. And it often comes up, you know, why is this taking so long? And I've been with Taylor when she's, you know, patiently explained to people, which has allowed me to then to continue to patiently explain to them that, you know, it is the way that they evaluate cases, and you want to make sure, we address that all the time, we want to make sure that the defendant does get a good representation. We want to make sure that happens so that it reduces the chances on appeal. Just recently went through about 2 years with one client, and moved through many pretrial hearings and motions and those type of things through the trial, and now we'll be moving towards sentencing. And it was very interesting to see how the victim, who was the father in that case, was able to start to appreciate the defense providing a good defense for that person. He always had the core belief that everything would come out in his favor, in the victim's favor, which it did. This man will be serving a long time. But just him being able to talk through that with me on sometimes a weekly basis, sometimes several times a week. Just that's where I see our what Victims for Justice is able to provide to these victims. We are an agency, a nonprofit agency, that walks alongside with folks, can help them with referrals, that we're people that they can call even if they, you know, just have a little question, or maybe they are having trouble getting in touch with the prosecutor, or they just don't have time to track down that paralegal. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm there. Mm-hmm. I'm there, you know, 7.5 to 8 hours a day. So yeah. I make those calls for
them. And you're a known entity. Prosecutors know who you are, know your agency, mm-hmm. know the State Office for Victims' Rights. We're going to take a tiny little break and come back. And I hope maybe we talk a little bit about the current Me Too movement and the rise of interest and grassroots effort related to victims' rights. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm here with Senior Judge Elaine Andrews as a co-host, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. My name is Kathleen McCoy, and I'm here with my co-host, Elaine Andrews. And we are talking about victims' rights today on the show, and we have two experts in the studio with us in this area. Taylor Winston is director of the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, and Michelle Evans is the lead victim advocate for Victims for Justice. So, Elaine, you wanted to jump in with a little bit about resources.
Yes, so. I mean, I'm, you know, obviously, I think Michelle has done an excellent job explaining sort of the incalculable loss that sometimes only just holding someone's hand is going to make up for it. But there are other losses that are victim related, such as money, physical injury, medical expenses. I'm wondering what resources are available to victims, and how do either one of you help victims access monetary or other kinds of resources?
So at OVR, we don't actually provide any financial resource help to victims, but we will refer them to the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. Primarily, that's for victims of violent crimes, though not property crimes. And then we'll try to work with them with regards to their constitutional right to restitution from the criminal defendant. And, of course, that is dependent upon there being a conviction in the case. So we work with them to gather the documentation they may need to help support whatever amount of money they're going to be requesting in that restitution. Sadly, though, the vast majority of victims don't see restitution from the offender. And so there has been some recent movement, a new law, which Representative Kopp sponsored, the governor recently signed, and I worked with Representative Kopp on it, which establishes a restitution justice account, which will be funded by the legislature from offender PFDs, which would allow whatever money that the legislature, you know, appropriates for that year to be used to pay past restitution orders that have not been paid on by the defendants, in hope of providing at least a little bit of restorative justice to the victims who have been left with that component unsatisfied.
Is that retroactive? Can it go back?
Oh, yes. It can go back.
How far?
As far as restitution orders have been. Okay. And so an OVR will be actually administering this process for victims. So any victim who is, you know, out there who has an unpaid restitution order can come to our office and we can get the ball rolling. It just got passed, so right now there's not money in that account, but it will come up for appropriation purposes next spring.
So that's fascinating. Is it? So if a person is convicted of a felony, they lose their right to the PFD. So if, for example, I'm just suggesting this, a felony drug person is in jail for the next 5 years, they don't actually owe restitution to anyone, but their PFD, instead of them not being eligible for it, they actually, the money that they would have gotten had they not been convicted does get paid, but it gets paid into to this victim's fund.
Well, it goes into a fund, a pool of money. The majority of that money actually is used. It was supposed to be used for victims. originally. And that's where our office was going to be funded 100% from that fund originally, and it was. But now most of the money goes to offender health care for DOC, and there's a pool of money left. Some can go to us, some to VCCB, the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and other victim agencies within the state. But this is a new little fund that's been developed also that can receive money from that bigger pool of offender PFD money to help with restoration of the victim through restitution.
So, and can you tell us a little bit about the Violent Crimes Victim Compensation Fund?
And I can tell you a little bit about that. That is one of the things that our agency, so the Violent Crimes Compensation Board is really a small office in Juneau. They have three people on staff. And so they rely on victim service agencies throughout the state to assist victims in filling out that information. You can do that through your My Alaska account, actually, online. But what I find often is, when something's happened to you, and that's Victims for Justice, we do work with victims of violent crime. That is our limitation as well. We're not working with property crimes. So that's a pretty dramatic event. If it's an assault, a kidnapping, a homicide. I know myself, when I have to go somewhere and they hand me five sheets of paper and tell me I have to fill it out, even on a good day, I'm a little overwhelmed. And so I see that as something that I can do. I'm very familiar with those forms. I bring those people into my office. I assist them in filling them out, and there's different attachments. So I can get that filled out for them, get them signed. I get them off to Juneau, and we start that process.
So what kinds of things get compensated? Would be uninsured medical, property loss?
Not so much property loss.
No.
Medical and dental,
funeral
and burial, counseling.
Okay.
Are some big ones.
Lost wages,
those, and everything, of course, has its different categories,
right.
Its limitations.
Right.
But also loss of support for minors. So if you have someone who was a working person in Alaska and they were killed in a homicide, if they have children, you can apply for a loss of support for them. And so there is a cap on the amount of money that they give to each in each case, and that's $40,000. And then they have other little caps and limitations on some things.
We've got a caller with a question about the Victim Rights Fund. So I'd like to welcome Harry onto Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. Hi, Harry.
Hi there. So a few years ago, I was in the legislature, and one of my constituents came to me and said that his children had their mother's PFD taken away from them because she had spent a night in jail during the year. And we passed a law a number of years ago that said, if you spend at least a night in jail, that we take away the PFD. But in all other cases, that PFD goes first to the children, dependent children on that that person, non-custodial parent. And anyway, we got that bill passed to put the non-custodial children back in the number one position, and the governor basically just ignored the law, and we got it passed unanimously in both houses, and it's been ignored ever since. So that's one place where that fund from the PFDs is not going to the place that the legislature actually intended for at least a portion of it to go. There's something like $2 to $5 million per year that goes back to that fund that pays for inmate health. And the former governor, not this one, but The former governor just said that, you know, that we couldn't afford that, that we had to put that back into inmate health.
Hmm. Well, do you have a particular question? You just wanted to make that remark, Kerry.
Well, I'm just saying that there's more than one entity that's after the money that goes into that pool of money that they were talking about.
We have shaking heads here, people agreeing with you. Do either of you have a comment for Harry, or do they just they hear what you're saying, essentially? So yeah, I don't think either agency or either representative can really say anything about it. They understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I just wish we'd get the governor to acknowledge that you know, those children deserve those PFDs, whether whether the you know the offending parent did or not.
Right. Understood. And it's great that you had a chance to raise that issue on the radio, and we really thank you for calling. And now people know they want to get behind something, that's something there that you're looking for some support. So thanks a lot, Harry. I appreciate your phone call.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just, this is Kathleen, just thinking, I'm reading so much about the Me Too movement in the media. It's national. It's not necessarily an Alaskan issue, but I wonder if it is inspiring. I'm curious about folks who are dealing with victims, whether it's empowering them in ways that maybe wasn't the case years ago. I'm just curious how this national movement is happening, is affecting us locally. And I guess a secondary question is just the idea that, especially with sexual assault, the impact on a victim is kind of for a lifetime, right? But we have statutes of limitations for people to be able to raise this issue. And some people will discount later accusations, if this, you know. So I just think there's a whole lot there that isn't settled yet. So, you know, are you seeing a resurgence in interest or empowerment among victims locally based on what's happening nationally? Do you have anything to say about statutes of limitations for people to raise their issues?
Well, most of the sexual offense crimes don't have statute of limitations anymore. There are a few, but more the serious ones don't. So it's open-ended.
Did that change recently? Or?
Well, it changed. Not recently. It changed quite a few years back. It was kind of a stair step. So, you know, there have been different periods of time. But, I can't tell you exactly when, but it's been a number of years when it went to no statute of limitations on the more serious offenses.
That's good to know. It's good to know. Yeah.
But I think that, I haven't seen anything specifically at OVR about the resurgence of sort of an interest or a movement due to the Me Too movement. I mean, I do think it correlates with what I believe in, and what we see is that certainly people may feel more comfort now that there are others out there and to come out and report what's happened to them where they might not have previously. And certainly I also think there's a lot of importance to grassroots movements. I always encourage my victims, especially the homicide family victims, but any victim, to take this really black, dark cloud they're in and try to turn it inside out to find whatever sliver of silver lining they can and do something to help other victims or change the system. And certainly the Moore family, they were clients of mine, and I've told them that in the beginning, as I have many other victims, and they really ran with it. And I'm so proud that they can make some changes. And there are many other victims who do the same and make changes. And they help other victims who maybe don't have the courage at one point or another to come out to see, okay, maybe I can find the courage to do that.
Yeah, and I think another example you see outside of the sexual assault realm, but maybe in the school shooting realm, where you see parents, or Elaine, you brought up Mothers Against Drunk Driving, you know, who actually begin to ask for bigger changes, and some of these things that we seem stuck on or divided about bring new energy to the argument. So one thing I wanted to mention to people is that I sent this to Elaine, a link to a New Yorker article that was called The History of the Victims' Rights Movement that just came out. Jill Lepore wrote it. We have a link to it on alaskapublic.org. Under Hometown Alaska, but I didn't know about the history, really, and one of the interesting points that was brought up was that originally, we're talking way back in the 60s, that there was a sense that the state was overpowering defendants, and so there were some defendants' rights. And Elaine, you probably know things about this, but then that moved along for a while. But then there was a sense that victims didn't have rights, and so that, you know, and I remember one of the things I read in the article was that defendants' rights were not anti-victims' rights; they were, you know, rights for the defendant against what they write is sort of an overpowering state authority, you know. So it's just really interesting how this evolved. The story talks about how feminism and conservatism have come together on the same topic. So I just I encourage people to read it because it's got some of the history of the victims' rights movement beyond Alaska, and it just gives you food for thought. So,
well, and I think one of the things from just from my point of view is, and I think the thing that's quite visible to the outside world are is this whole notion of victim impact statements that. You know, it in the traditional criminal sentencing, when I first started as a judge in 1981, prosecutor made a sentencing argument, defense made a sentencing argument. Defendant had the last word. He had his right to or her right to allocution, and then the judge sentenced. And there was no opportunity for a victim impact statement. So that's how I started as a judge, and I really saw and grew with and had to learn to deal with victim impact statements. Maybe you folks can talk a little bit about those and how you help people prepare them and what advice you give to people about victim impact statements.
Okay. Certainly that is a right for victims to make that impact statement either in writing or orally or both. And so I always encourage every victim to do that, to say their piece to the judge, to tell the judge whatever they feel the judge should know to make the best decisions in the sentencing process, whether it's about the crime itself, some knowledge they may have about the defendant that maybe other people don't have in the system, information about them or their victim, loved victim, and then anything they would like to see from the court specifically on the sentence. You know, certainly we counsel them to make sure that they're appropriate with their language, you know, and direct their comments to the judge because it's the judge who is having to make the decisions. But it is their time to speak and to take advantage of that. And it also can have an impact later on, especially the written form, because if they've put something in writing and it's part of a pre-sentence report or another package, that will stay in the defendant's file so that, you know, parole boards down the road can also review those materials. And it may have an effect on those decisions later on.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, do you have anything to add to that topic, or is
Absolutely.
That pretty much your job?
Yeah, well, you know, just to sit down with folks to, you know, coach them with similar things that Taylor has said, and to be able to, I've sat down with one lady who, you know, again, she had so many emotions, and she just had a paragraph here and a paragraph there. You know, we're able to sit down with her and kind of, you know, for an hour and a half, where, you know, we could just sit down and write that down in a flow that really told that story about, you know, what happened to her, what the impact was, the financial impact, the emotional impact, and always reminding folks that they are, you know, they are addressing the judge, they're addressing the court. It's very difficult because, you know, they have, there's so much emotion, and they do want to just, you know, talk directly to that defendant, which, you know, different judges, different courtrooms allow, you know, have some leeway on that. Mm-hmm. You know, just being there for those folks and helping them process through all of that information is one of the things that we're able to do at our office.
It sounds like a pretty traumatic statement to have to write. You know, so one of the things I read, I was going all the way back to the Timothy McVeigh trial, where they really were dealing with whether there should be victim impact statements. And I remember one thing I read the judge said that stuck with me is he was very conservative about it. It was new territory. He was trying to do the right thing. But he said, this is a trial, not a theater. You know, he was really worried about the emotional sentimentality, whatever you want to call it. But it doesn't happen. Impact statements happen at sentencing. Am I right?
Yes.
And Well, we got to take a break. I'm just going to stop right there before I get going. You're listening to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy here with my co-host, Elaine Andrews.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy here with co-host Elaine Andrews. Victims' rights is our topic today. And I just want to throw out our phone numbers here before we're in our last segment here. And if you're interested in joining our conversation, you can do it at 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide, or send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Our guests today are Taylor Winston from the Alaska Office of Victims' Rights and Michelle Evans, lead victim advocate for Victims for Justice. And anyway, I was just talking about this idea of trials versus theaters and judges. This is new territory, trying to let the victim be heard, but it can be so emotional. So anyway, Elaine, you said you could pick up there a little bit.
Right. Well, having done sentencings for as long as I did without the victim impact statements, and then having a victim impact statement, the courtroom is a highly structured place, and this is a place where the person who's now talking doesn't necessarily understand the structure. So for judges, I think it was a little bit disconcerting because there's no objection sustained, overruled. Have people who don't really understand the rules of court, and so I don't know this for a fact, but my guess is there was a little bit of resistance to it initially, and people were finding their way. But I can tell you, those were tremendously important statements for judges to hear. I mean, a judge goes out prepared on a sentencing. You have a pre-sentence report. It could be 20 or 30 pages long. You've read over appellate sentencing cases. I mean, judges don't get to just sentence any way they want. There's lots of rules about how much you can and can't do, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to go out prepared, knowing the ranges of what you might be doing, listening with an open mind to the prosecutor's argument, listening with an open mind to the defense argument. But without the victim statement, we were missing something. And so there is no question that that statement moves things up or down for the convicted person. And they're called the victim impact statement for a reason. Mm-hmm. They really do impact mm-hmm. the decision maker.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to throw this question out. And, the recent case with the athletic coach and the gymnast, and there were something like 159 victims who were allowed to give victim statements. It was really emotional. It was televised. It was really amazing. Before the show, Elaine, you brought up the point that some of these things that were being discussed by victims had not been to court. I mean, there was no particular evidence. So it's just it's very emotional, but you have to understand the grounds under which it's happening, I guess, right?
Yeah, I don't know that kind of impact statement would happen in Alaska, because I know certainly the victim can make, and there are people who, I mean, the definition of victim is wide. It's not mm-hmm. just the person who was assaulted. It could be a family member who's mm-hmm. affected by it. So we do have a fairly wide definition of people who can make these statements. But, a string of witnesses who were not part of the prosecution.
Would not happen here?
I don't know. I would be surprised.
It can, in some regards. Sometimes there's global agreements, meaning a defendant has had multiple cases, and there's a plea agreement, which resolves it down to one charge. But there have been a number of victims in all those other cases that are getting dismissed as part of this agreement, and they would still have an opportunity to speak
so
in
could
those
have.
Cases.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And also victims of other crimes potentially of the defendants can certainly write a letter into the court, and it's called a letter in support of the victim, and those can be made part of the record also, so that they're there for the judge to at least have that information.
I want to think that we've been in at least one sentencing together where a community member just felt compelled to show up in court and just say, you know, on behalf of the community, you know, this has affected me, and this is how. And so I don't think it's, you know, not happening a lot, but I do remember at least one, and I think that Office of Victims' Rights and Victims for Justice were both in the courtroom when that was delivered, and it was just somebody, you know, a concerned community member that felt compelled.
How did they actually get the judge to notice them or to...
Well, They would indicate to the judge, and then a request would be made that person would like to speak, and it's up to the discretion of the judge. I mean, there really isn't anything in the statute that obligates or dictates that friends and family members of the defendant speak. That's up to the discretion of the judge also. So mm-hmm. So there is room, you know, for other people to chime in mm-hmm. if the judge would like to hear from them.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I have another. Eileen, do you have a question you want to
no.
pop in? Recently we've seen, you know, a big headline in local paper about rural paraprofessionals and that we don't have the same training for people across the state, and I know you're both served statewide, so that's an issue. And then there's the budget. I keep wondering how the budget is going to affect all of these things. And I know that we've had stories in the last year about the troopers having vacancies and struggling and some retirements coming up. So I think even maybe Girdwood is even being handled by Anchorage at this point because there's not a troop, you know. So troopers are under pressure because there's not enough numbers. I wondered about people in rural Alaska not having sufficient public safety, and do you regard them as victims that you should be advocating for, maybe, you know, arguing with the legislature to get more funding or to make uniform standards again for, you know, what do you think about all of that? Is this a really burning issue in our state right now?
From OVR's perspective, and we don't specifically advocate for certain funding levels for law enforcement agencies. Clearly, what we're doing is advocating for victims when they've reported something and it's not being followed up with mm-hmm. with police, that we're advocating for them with that law enforcement agency and, if necessary, with other agencies too. So it's a huge problem because we have a vast state, you know, with rural areas that are hard to touch, and every place is affected by the budget issues. I mean, local and statewide. Plus, you know, it's hard to live in some of these rural areas, so it's hard to draw people into those areas, especially if there aren't, you know, great salaries or, you know, great chances for advancement. I mean, it's a career move and a career decision for a lot of folks. So there's just a lot of issues in being able to provide, you know, great law enforcement out in the bush. And I mean, there's a lot of great people out in the bush,
but there just
aren't enough. And how do you fix that?
Yeah, because there had been that very dramatic story about a village police officer involved in a crime, then I found on the UAA Justice Center a report from the spring about the fact that really a lot of cases do get referred for prosecution, VPSOs and VPOs and tribal police, that they're having a very, you know, but it was like a sweeping story that it's like, oh my gosh, people aren't trained enough out, and what are we going to do? But, you know, a lot of good things do happen. And so you just have to take all that information in. But it's really, you're not allowed to advocate in that regard for funding or for, you know, anything like that.
Well, OVR could, but we just don't feel that that's our place. I mean, we're a victim advocacy group, so we try to look and advocate legislatively for things that directly affect victims. And while we may support, maybe there's something that comes by and they say, you know, would you sign on to this? Would you lend your support to this particular statute or this particular? We'll be happy to, if it's affecting victims, do that. But we don't feel that it's our place to actually be out advocating for certain levels of funding, because we're not involved in the funding process for law enforcement
agencies. Okay, yeah. Just was curious about that. You know, sort of victims in waiting is what I see.
Well, and it is, like Taylor said, it's very, very difficult when, you're looking, being a statewide agency, but we're based in Anchorage. And we just recently went through the grant cycle with the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And though they focus primarily on domestic violence and sexual assault, they were able to see fit to grant us an amount of funds, though we focus on what they determine underserved crimes. So some homicide, burglary, assault, those are determined as underserved crimes. And so we are actually in this next year hoping to reach out into Fairbanks area and actually place a victim advocate in the Fairbanks area that will help you know, expand our reach further. And I mean, I've worked with victims all the way, you know, up to Uktiavik, down to Cake. But they, just by virtue of being out in the bush and further away, they don't hear about victim services or are able to access victim services as much as maybe someone in a more urban setting. And so we're really looking forward to being able to possibly be a little more visible. We also got funds to be able to hire an outreach person as well. So we're hoping for a big growth year and being able to reach out and be more active and available to victims. I mean, that's part of the process. When you're a victim, you don't plan on that. You know, that's not something you're like, oh, well, you know, I have this to-do list that if I ever become a victim, I'm going to access it. And so part of it is just having word of mouth. We have several people lately have come, shown up at our door or given me a call and said, you know, my friend so-and-so told me to give you a call because they knew that you guys helped out in this particular case. And just getting that word out there that there are victim services, that there are some things that are available. Yeah. Our municipality, as well as the state, has also provided us with funds so that we, you know, evaluating everybody's case individually, have some emergency funds that we're able to assist folks with. As you know, even as we may be processing their violent crimes compensation board, you know, anytime you're dealing with paperwork that has to go to Juneau, that has to be processed, if you don't have groceries that week, you know, what do you do? And of course, we're providing people with information for local food banks and those type of things. But we are able to help with some security and safety issues, as well sometimes as gift cards for groceries or in some instances, even assistance for rent.
Yeah. You know, Michelle, I'm curious about how you're the lead advocate, right? How what's your caseload like? How many cases are you involved in? And other your colleagues there at Victims for Justice, how many of them are there?
Well, there's some.
There's
that's,
me.
That's a trick question.
Oh,
it is. There actually are two of us. Tori Shanklin is the executive director, and then I, being the lead advocate, am also the only advocate at this time.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
But we position that title for growth because we are, you know, we are fixin'. I have a little Southern background. We are getting ready to hire.
Oh, you're going to say fixin'?
Fixin'. We are getting ready to hire a Fairbanks advocate, hopefully, in the near future, as well as the outreach coordinator. So we're hoping to, you know, double. what we currently have. And
Do you spend all your time in court?
I do not spend all my time in court because many of these cases end up in endless pretrial hearings, which are more like scheduling events. And so we do try to, you know, carve out those times to for trial or bail hearings at the beginning. You know, those are very important hearings to attend for victims as well.
Yeah, right.
But we do have families that are very invested in attending every pretrial hearing. They want to make sure that that the court knows that they are interested. You know, that's one of their fears is that the court will forget that there's a victim involved. And so many of our victims want to be at every hearing so that that judge sees their face, so that everybody knows that they're still interested, they're watching.
Mm-hmm. I know whenever there's media coverage of a big trial, there's lots of commentary about who's sitting behind the family or what. You know, there's a lot of community interest when there's a high profile crime. So, yeah. You know, we just have a couple minutes left, and I usually warn you in advance saying I want you to suggest at the end what you want people to take away from a program like this. You know, if there's one thing they walk away thinking about. So I just wonder if I didn't warn you in advance, and I usually try to do that so you have a minute to think about it. I don't spring it on you. But, you know, you do a lot of public education and public interaction, and there may be things you know people ask over and over, or you just want people to know. So I don't know. I don't mean to put deer in the headlights or scare you or anything. But you want to try that?
Sure.
Okay.
I'll try that.
Go ahead.
The things that I would want, especially victims out there, but anybody who knows a victim, to know that there are services to help them and that they also have a voice, even if they never want to come to the Victims for Justice or OVR for help, that they have a voice and not to be afraid to use their voice. If they're in the courtroom and want to say something about bail because nobody's, you know, recognizing they're there, or at sentencing, to just raise their hand and say, I'm the victim, you know, because sometimes things do fall through the cracks. Mm-hmm. But to know that they have rights and there are people out there who can help them and help protect their rights.
And we do have your website on alaskapublic.org, mm-hmm. or if you simply do Office for Victims Rights, it pops right up on the internet. You're easy to find. Mm-hmm. How about you, Michelle?
Well, I echo a lot of what Taylor has said, and just to let people know that we do work, you know, together, all the V's, OVR, Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and Victims for Justice. You know, they'll call up my office and they'll want to talk to Taylor, and happily able to, you know, pass that along to the correct office. But that they aren't alone, that there are people out there that that can help and that will listen. And if they feel stuck, again, encourage them to move through the process with help and be heard.
Right. Well, you probably can hear the jingle of the music, which really means we have to round this up. So I want to really thank both people who listened today and the callers, but also Taylor Winston, Director of Alaska Office of Victims' Rights, Michelle Evans, Lead Victim Advocate for Victims for Justice, and of course my co-host Elaine Andrews. Hometown Alaska is on a short hiatus for the next 2 weeks. I'll be back as your host for the next Hometown Alaska on July 11, when we host representatives from the Alaska Botanical Garden and its 25th birthday year. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Justice Alaska on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.